And that's one of the things we love about the work around character is to a certain extent that you started this particular segment around saying, you know, leaders aren't born, they're made. And 100%, like the dimensions of characters, habits of behavior. Now, you may have grown up in an environment where you had lots of positive models and you could see that, and maybe not. But one of the things we love about the work, to me anyway, it democratizes this element of leadership. You can sit down and diagnose what your character is, and then you can prescribe a course of action to actually change that. And it allows you to start to access almost those X factors of leadership that maybe you see in great leaders, but you don't quite get it. This actually reveals why they're great leaders and how you can become more like them.
In her book, Conversational Intelligence, Judith Glasser wrote, "To get to the next level of greatness depends on the quality of our culture, which depends on the quality of our relationships, which depends on the quality of our conversations. Everything happens through conversations." Welcome to Conversations, powered by Quantivos. Welcome to this episode of Conversations. I'm Brian Gorman, your host and a coach here at Quantivos. And our guest today is Bill Furlong. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Brian. I'm delighted to be here.
Bill is one of three authors, along with Mary Croson and Gerard Seitz, of The Character Compass, Transforming Leadership for the 21st Century. And that's what we're going to be talking about today, is character. So, Bill, first question, how did this book come about?
So good question, Brian. So Gerard and Mary are both longtime tenured professor at Ivy Business School. Ivy Business School being kind of like the Harvard of the North, maybe is the way to explain it to your listeners. Very case-oriented. And they've been working on character from an academic perspective. And again, like Harvard, there's a deep theory connected to deep practice perspective. Since about 2010, I joined them as an executive in residence about 2013, really trying to bring what I would characterize as like the practical perspective, if you will, like how does this play in organizations and amongst leaders? But really, because I'm not an academic, I was doing an awful lot of work with them, but really supporting them. They've written a couple of books before, but most recently decided to have one maybe in 2022 during the pandemic. They thought it was time for their next in this series of books. And they wanted it to be a book that was practitioner oriented. So they approached me and said, you know, given all that we've been doing and looking at and experiencing and observing and practicing around character, would you join us as a third co-author? And really the view is to take a lot of the experience and frameworks and what works well and what doesn't work well and stories, and then apply to the work around leadership character to give the reader this sense of everything from, you know, why does character matter? To how do you develop it, assess it, all those kinds of things we think we're going to talk about, all the way to the organization, all the way up to the board. It was the idea that they were now ready for this kind of book. They had enough content where they could share these practitioner lessons to tack on to or add on to what you would characterize as a pretty strong academic foundation.
Definitely a strong academic foundation. This is not a, gee, I have an idea book.
Yeah.
And also very practical. And that was one of the things I really appreciated about it. Up front, very early on in the book, you write, "To be effective, leaders need to draw on the C's, competencies, commitment, and character." We do a lot of work around competency and commitment. Most organizations don't do a whole lot about character. And again, in the book, you talk about the fact that character is contagious. So if we bring the character that we don't want into the organization and don't inoculate ourselves pretty quickly, that can travel far and wide. Bill, how do you define character? Let's start there.
So that's a great question. And embedded in your preamble to that question is a little bit like, why haven't organizations engaged in character, right? Because everyone kind of knows it's important. But, and I think that the work that really began this work around leadership character really came from the global financial crisis, where Mary and Gerard and a few other academic peers looked at the global financial crisis and went, what went wrong? Talked to individuals around the world. There was answers like, oh, the human resources compensation systems were wrong, or the risk systems were wrong, or the culture was wrong. But the one common thing that everyone had was there was an absence of character. And so then they asked people around the world, okay, so what do you mean by character? And they got 300 different answers. You know, everyone had this sort of subjective view of character. And that's then was, oh, okay, well, we're academics. Our job is to go away and define that. So I'll say the first thing that we often find in having these conversations around character is a little bit of what it's not, or in the context of what we're talking about, what it's not. And there's this almost immediately, and I was saying myself when I first ran into the character work in 2012, 2013, there's almost a thought, oh, it's morals and ethics, right? It's, this is really what we're talking about. And the definition of character is broad enough to include morals and ethics. But again, this is a business school, not a school of philosophy or theology or psychology. And so what they did is they really took the work that had been done in philosophy and the work that had been done in psychology and ported it into the world of business, really through organizations and leadership. So that's where they began to think about it. So it's more than just morals and ethics. The essence of the work and the reason why the business school cares and the reason why I hope your listeners care as well, Brian, we think it's the underpinnings of good performance and well-being. Sometimes those two things are thought of being mutually, but almost like, you can have great performance, but your life's going to be terrible, or you're going to have a great life, but good, you know, kiss your performance goodbye kind of thing. And our view is actually that's a false choice. It's not an either or, it's actually an and. So with that set up, Brian, what do we think about character? Like, so how do we define character? So the essence of character is that it's behaviors. So it's really important to recognize that it's not personality. So there's a personality, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but there's the big five personality traits, right? Like extroversion, introversion, agreeableness, neuroticism, conscientiousness, and open to experience. It's almost like that's, you're kind of bored with that. There's a space and or a range inside of which you can work and operate. But really, when we talk about character, we're really thinking about the habits of behavior that you exhibit every single day. And a lot of the work has been done in psychology. So Peterson and Seligman, the VIA project, and done in the US is fabulous work. They originally thought about picking up simply those definitions, but that wasn't really suitable in many cases for organizational work and leadership work. So they ended up breaking it down into 11 separate dimensions of character. And each of the dimensions are, and sometimes people come, well, couldn't you break it down to 4 or 5 or something? And I thought the same thing. And so the answer is you probably can't, and they've actually done academic work to recognize that you can't. And so those 11 dimensions of character would be things that I think everyone would recognize, things like drive and integrity and courage and accountability, right? The stuff that you almost always see written on the walls of organizations. But it also includes some things that you might not expect to see, and certainly things I didn't expect to see, humanity and humility and justice. And the idea is that each one of those, and so those, there's 10 dimensions like that, and they're in the book, and we could talk about any one of the things you like. Temperance is a big one, by the way, but they're all surround the central dimension of character, which is judgment. And so each one of those different dimensions of character, they all work together mutually and almost like in concert as to produce the best judgments. So what's really important then about that is each one of the dimensions on their own is important. Transcendence, courage. It's, you know, if you need courage, you better have a reservoir of courage that's deep enough there to reach for it that you want it. The same thing with humility and humanity and justice. When you need it, you need to have the reservoir there. But not every context calls for a ton of courage, but it might call for a ton of humanity. And what's important to recognize is that they work together in a way that the engines and a brake of a race car work together. So the engine is kind of like drive, literally. Temperance is something like brakes. And one of the things about race cars is what really defines them on the F1 circuit, how fast they can get around. It's less about the engine and more about the brakes. How fast can you go into a corner so you carry that speed into a corner and your brakes can help you through that corner and get you back out again? So there's this interplay of all of these different dimensions, and each one is defined by a series of behaviors. That's the essence of the work and then how they connect.
And one of the things that really struck me, I had never given any thought to this before, is you talk about the fact that you can have an excess of any of those dimensions, which is as, I guess, unhealthy as having a deficit. Could you give us an example?
Sure. So I'll give you sort of I'll work with the example I gave, and then I'll sort of go into the real world, if you will, and maybe give you a couple of examples. So the example in the race car circuit is if you've got a huge engine and your brakes are pretty poor, it's just a matter of time before you crash, right? So that's someone who's got a ton of courage, a ton of drive, but they don't have much in the way of temperance and patience. So now let's take that and you look at the global financial crisis, right? There was no shortage of super smart people working really hard and trading floors around the world. But that wasn't the issue. There was more a case of there was tons of drive, tons of courage, many cases, a lot of accountability in terms of the work that they were doing. But where was the humility and the humanity? And so you start getting into these couplets. In the book, there's a number of different ones that we mention. One that always comes to mind, and I hope none of your listeners work at Volkswagen, but it's out there, is that Volkswagen in the middle teens had their emissions crisis. And there was an example of the engineers using their excellent competencies around that to achieve an outcome. So you could look at that in the context of drive and courage and really pushing their competencies. But on the other hand, where was that sense of humanity and humility and a sense of justice around that? And so you bump into issues like that. We would argue this, you see the same thing at Boeing with the 737 MAX. When you look at sort of what the issues have occurred around there, those start to get into issues of culture as well, of course. The issues at Theranos was another example of where there was this imbalances of characters. And another example that Mary and I first talked about it years ago was, I never thought you could have an excess of something like integrity. I thought that, you know, integrity is foundational. How could you have too much integrity? Well, you can if you don't have much in the way of humanity and humility to support it. So imagine someone, Brian, who's got an enormous amount of integrity, candor. They will tell you exactly what they think all the time without filter. But if there's no sense of humanity or humility, that kind of person is harder to be around and they can be very dogmatic and very rigid. It's never the case where we say to someone, okay, you've got too much integrity, you need to dial it down. No, strength and integrity is great. What's really important is you have to recognize what that sort of imbalance is, the problems it's causing you and the problems that it's causing the people that you work with. So now we're getting into performance and well-being, and that don't dial down integrity. We love that you have integrity. Dial up the other dimensions so that integrity brings itself back into that golden mean, which is what Aristotle would have talked about, bring it back into the range of a virtue.
You're touching on a couple of things that I want to get into a little bit. When you talked about culture, I spent a lot of years in organizational change management. We talked about culture all the time. We worked on culture change all the time. And it wasn't until I got into coaching that I really became sensitive to the fact that there is no culture outside of the people. And so having a courageous culture, having a healthy character culture is all about how your people show up, the actions they're taking, what they're doing. You had mentioned temperance. And again, this was a new term for me in terms of character. I always think of temperance in terms of the Prohibition era here in the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about what temperance is all about when it comes to character?
So, and I hope we get back to culture too, Brian, because there's some stuff I'd love to talk about, maybe even very briefly around culture. Temperance, I might not be the best person to talk to about temperance because it consistently is my lowest dimension. And so I spend a lot of time working on it. So temperance is really the idea of patience, calm, composed, self-controlled, prudent. And it's one of those dimensions that is so hard to develop and then to sustain. And the reason is because we're all, I mean, the nature of our society, we work at a breakneck speed. The more we take on, the more we can achieve, the more we get compensated, the more success we have, the more we think about that. And so we're all in this enormous rush to get things done. And the idea around temperance, and actually we talk about temperance as being the gateway through which all of the other dimensions are expressed. So if you might have an enormous amount of humility and humanity, you've someone who's like forgiving and empathetic, but if you don't have the dimension of temperance that's been developed, when the situation calls for you to express that behavior, if you don't have patience and calm, you'll just go right through that stop sign kind of thing and not behave in the way that's appropriate. So temperance is critical. We often think about it as well as almost like breathing. And actually, one of the ways to develop temperance is actually through the practice of meditation and the sense of being mindful. Temperance is really something that in your normal day-to-day activities, when you're not under stress, you don't really think about it. Like patience and calm, it's a calm environment. And then going back to your comments on culture, but what about when an organizational culture is one that is at a breakneck speed? So the context around you is driving that. What if you're having a difficult day? You know, you didn't get a good night's sleep. You've got a number of deadlines coming up. You've got a stressful meeting to go to. Those are the times when if you don't have that habit of temperance, it's almost like a golfer's swing during a stressful moment, your temperance will break down. And so it's kind of like breathing. You don't really think about your breathing, but you think about it when you're stressed. For example, if you're climbing at height, so you're a mountain climber, breathing is everything. Or you're scuba diving at 150 meters or 100 meters or even 50 meters, breathing is everything. So you have to practice that dimension of temperance in order to have the habit of temperance. That's a bit of a lifelong journey for many of us, especially for many of your listeners who no doubt are hard, driving, ambitious leaders. But it is, again, the portal, the gateway through which all the other dimensions are expressed.
I recorded actually two podcasts a while back with Brad Deitzer. And Brad is the author of his most recent book, which was the focus of our podcast, is Belonging Rules. And it really is, these are how you as a leader need to behave in order to create that sense of belonging for everyone in the organization. Deitzer, his company, has mandatory quiet time, meditation, to bring that sense of temperance into the workplace. Let's go back to culture.
Before we do that, just really quickly, that's a brave choice. And one of the things about developing character, if we come back to that, many of the ways we develop character are what I would characterize as unconventional. In other words, people, like, I remember when I first started getting engaged in meditation about maybe 10 years ago, when I was working in capital markets 20 years ago, my mindset, Brian, was, who's got time for meditation? Like, I'm so busy. What I didn't recognize was, is if I had that time to meditate, that 10 to 15 minutes of meditation changes the other 23 hours and 50 or 45 minutes of my day and actually creates space. I never got that. And I never understood again why meditation was so important and why that quiet room is so important, because it creates space for people, creates well-being, it creates this sense of, like, I think people make better decisions when they're feeling calm and they can sort of move themselves out of it. But it's one of those things where it's a bit unconventional, but it's the only way to develop character. As Aristotle had said, you can only become virtuous by acting virtuously. You can only become patient by acting patiently. And so the trick is how do you do that? You have to practice it through things like meditation.
I very often work with my clients around their breath, because if you can come to center, you can access not only your head, but your heart and your gut. And they play just as important part in leadership as the head does.
I think, and that's precisely the idea of the work around character. We talked a bit about character, competence, and commitment, you know? And competence is kind of the head part of it. Commitment is the part around, well, leadership does require, like, it's aspirational, and so there's got to be a focus and an intensity to that. But the part that's missing is this gut, or what we call the character part of who you are as a person. And our view is that organizations need to elevate a character to the level of competence. In order to give them, their employees, the opportunity to achieve their most potential, while at the same time having a sense of well-being, while at the same time bringing their whole selves to work, as opposed to walking in the door and suppressing some part of themselves because the culture tells them that that doesn't fit here.
I want to pick up on that character in the gut. And many of my listeners have heard me talk about this before. Not every neuroscientist uses the same language, but they all agree. We actually have as many motor neurons and sensory neurons in our guts as a cat has in its head. And the gut is the seat of courage, self-protection, and who we are at our core.
One of my favorite sayings, Brian, is, I can't remember the name of the neuroscientist who mentioned it, but we are not thinking machines that feel. We are feeling machines that think. And that, to me, is such an important part of leadership. If you can't manage yourself, it's pretty hard to manage other people. And some of the work, and it's in the book, and you've had probably a chance to look at it, it might be too much depth here, but we talk about the PABCs associated with character development, the core beliefs, cognition, affect, behavior, and physiology. And so much of that part of the gut is that physiology, those physical systems, the amygdala, that gets activated by the context. And so much of that work needs to be, especially, and again, you don't need it most of the time, but when you need it, you really need it. And if you haven't practiced those habits around temperance, then when you reach for it, you'll find it's not there.
One of the things that we're talking around in this conversation is character is not you were born with it or you weren't. It can be developed. And for each of these elements of character, there are ways to be very intentional about strengthening it. I did a lot of work, still do some work around personal resilience. And we talk about the resilience muscles. Some of your earlier examples were along the same line. If I am highly organized, and that is my strongest resilience muscle, in times of stress, where am I going to go? Organized. That may not be the right muscle to use in this situation. The same way with these different elements of character. If we can't bring them into balance, not if we can't, if we don't bring them into balance, we're liable to be calling on the wrong ones.
Agreed. I can talk a little bit, if you like, about the idea around developing character. Maybe just sort of lay out some of that part of that framework. Is that okay?
Sure.
The one thing that we think about and we talk about is the book and the work is all around developing character, the different dimensions, you know? And as again, we've mentioned earlier, there's a lot of unconventionality associated with that. And you have to be it. You can't think about acting courageously. You have to actually start acting courageously. And I would suggest you start small and build up the habit, right? You don't run into the burning building on day one. You sort of work your way up to those kinds of things. But the thing is that your character is always developing. It's developing now by virtue of the context that you're in, by the choices and the decisions that you make every single day. And so much of that is unconscious. And sometimes we actually don't recognize the unconscious choices that we've made and how it doesn't serve us. When we land up in a situation, for example, if you've gotten into the habit of avoiding difficult conversations, or you've gotten into the habit of maybe shying away from confrontation or challenge or something, when you really, really need it, that's the habit that's going to take over. So you've developed, or in this case, atrophied one of the dimensions of character by virtue of that. So it's just like muscles, right? If you're not working on cardio or your strength, just when you think you have to lift something up, you can't because you haven't been working on it. So your character is always developing. And our view is that it's such an incredibly important part of who you are, both personally and professionally. Why not make it intentional and intelligent as opposed to kind of this random thing? And that's one of the things we love about the work around character is to a certain extent that you started this particular segment around saying, you know, leaders aren't born, they're made. And 100%, like the dimensions of characters, habits of behavior. Now, you may have grown up in an environment where you had lots of positive models and you could see that, and maybe not. One of the things we love about the work, to me anyway, it democratizes this element of leadership. You can sit down and diagnose what your character is, and then you can prescribe a course of action to actually change that. And it allows you to start to access almost those X factors of leadership that maybe you see in great leaders, but you don't quite get it. This actually reveals why they're great leaders and how you can become more like them. So it's this idea of making it intelligent and making it intentional. There are unconventional things. It's things like music. It's things like meditation. I do improv work once a week, and I find the improv work is fabulous for things like humility, because I'm getting so much stuff wrong, but also being collaborative. There's a certain degree of courage, especially when you get on stage doing improv. So there's ways to do it, but you're not going to read it in a book. We do talk about in the book how there's these different stages. There's a discovery element. When you first discover and the work, as you read the work and expose to it, like both you and I have been over the years, you kind of think to yourself, I remember there was a time I had a ton of drive. And you kind of, oh, that's latent. Like, I can get that back. And then there's this stage that's sort of a discover. There's an activate. And sometimes just thinking about a dimension. I was heading into a meeting a couple of months ago. I was sensing a confrontation coming. And so I was kind of, you know, armoring up for battle, if you will. And then in a moment, I kind of thought, well, hold on. What dimensions am I missing here? Well, I think I might be missing the dimension of humility, right? What if I'm wrong? And what about the humanity? I think we're actually on the same page here. Why am I ascribing some motives to the people who I'm going to be working with here today? And so just sometimes just even thinking about the dimensions can actually start to change the behaviors, and it starts to modify. Again, everything's good about courage, but courage, which has not been calibrated and harnessed by humanity and humility, is going to become something which becomes toxic as opposed to becoming something that's positive. So there's that activate, there's the conscious strengthening of it, and then there's the connecting of the different dimensions together, and then there's this idea of sustaining, and that's kind of the highest level, is will your character hold up in all instances? And that's it's this lifelong journey, just in the same way that any kind of fitness is. It's a journey. And our view is, and it is backed up by the research, is if you're not working on it, the assumption you can make is that it's atrophying. It's getting weaker. And so it has to be this conscious part of it. A lot of the work comes from the habit development science, comes from sports. James Clear's work on atomic habits. You don't rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems. I think really applies here. If you're not systematically thinking about character 5 minutes a day, it'll get away from you. And that whole stuff around habit acquisition. There's an intentionality around it, and then there's the practice and this exercise. And over time, you become you. You become this person, which is, again, another thing that what I love about the work, Brian, and I'm sorry to be going on here a little bit, but what I love about it is that sometimes, and I know I felt this in mid-career, I kind of thought to myself, there's parts of me I just can't seem to change. I guess I'm just doomed to be that person. And the answer is no, you're not. You're not. That's a story you start to tell yourself.
That's a story. You can change the story.
And this is the roadmap we hope to give to people, a way of kind of going, oh, there it is. There's an awareness. I finally get it. In my case, it was things around humanity and humility and temperance. I get what's been holding me back. And so it's diagnostic, but it's also there's a prescriptive element to this, and this is how I fix it.
Back to culture. There were some things you wanted to bring up about culture early on in the conversation. Let's pick them up.
So thanks, Brian. I mean, the thing that, you know, you've heard the expression, culture eats strategy for breakfast, right? I think Peter Drucker is credited with saying that. Our view is that character eats culture for breakfast. And for exactly the reasons that you mentioned before, right? The culture of an organization is just really the aggregate of the behaviors that sit inside that organization. And when people talk about culture, and like my background is mostly financial services, you know, and they've had an enormous number of issues in culture, goes well beyond 2008. Culture is really this amalgam of behaviors, and organizations try and define what it is that they want, like a culture statement. I mean, it's Wells Fargo in 2015 had a fabulous culture statement, but just no one read it, right? Because what you put on the wall or what actually gets happened, I shouldn't say no one read it, but I mean, they clearly had a segment inside the organization where they were struggling with that. So it's not about what people say that they want, it's about the actual behaviors. And so they use words and they use actions. And I think the reasons that people really struggle with culture in that sense is a lot of those words become ambiguous. So what do you mean by, well, start with judgment or integrity or like these words. And so most people don't spend a lot of time thinking about what that means. They kind of go, okay, I kind of know what good judgment is, or I kind of know what integrity is. We think it's the work around character creates this accessible language that helps people really understand what it is about that particular value that you're expressing that's important to your organization. The second thing is that when you only put a couple of words on the wall, I think Enron, one of the words that Enron had on the wall was integrity, right? And probably innovation and something else, you know? The problem starts to become is when you only put a couple of words up on the wall, which is appropriate, those ones tend to be privileged. And then you turn integrity or innovation into a vice because you pursue that at all costs. I mean, the Volkswagen example really began when the CEO said, I want to be the biggest car manufacturer and seller in the world. All right, that's what we're going to be. So we'll figure that out. And part of figuring that out was cheating the emissions tests. So when you put a goal on the wall, when you put a value on the wall, if it's not balanced or softened or harnessed or calibrated or informed by the other dimensions, you will eventually get that imbalance, and you will eventually that get derailments, both in terms of individuals and organizations. So we've done this with a number of different organizations and leaders. This is what the golden mean looks like in terms of individual behavior, you know, courage or accountability or temperance or transcendence. We've also then ported that into culture. This is what a culture looks like when it's sitting inside of that of virtue as opposed to being a vice. And then we say to them, if that was how your organization behaved day in, day out, how would you be with that as a culture? And they'll come back, oh, this is exactly what I'm looking for, right? And so it resolves the ambiguity. It creates this language, and it also provides a safeguard against certain dimensions or values turning themselves into a vice. And so that together, this collective use. Now, there's always a place for specifics. So if you're a customer-driven organization, if you're an innovation-driven organization, whatever you think is important about you, that we think becomes the 10 or 20% that becomes special about who you are. And you can still have your three or four or five different, this is the values of who we are. But if you then infuse beneath that, not replace, but infuse beneath that a culture of character, then you can guard against the ambiguity and the privileging and the likelihood of virtues turning into vices.
We're working with one client who is driven by the corporate values. I have never seen a CEO, and this is a global organization, I have never seen a CEO who is so committed to driving their values to all levels of the organization. And just like so many companies, they lost a lot of people during COVID. So now they are very intentional about how do we bring these new people in and enculturate them to our values. And so we're actually doing this year a series of 15 workshops with frontline leaders around the country on living the values. And it is just unbelievable to listen to some of the stories that longer term members of this organization tell about how caring shows up, about how integrity shows up. It's just amazing. Bill, I hate to do this, but we're going to have to wrap this up. Any last words for our listeners?
I'd say the one thing I would share with your leaders is start with yourself. Just think about yourself and engage with yourself and strengthen yourself. And then you can start to turn to the world outside. But I think if you engage in the work, it becomes an enormously positive, transformative force in terms of how you perform at work, the nature of your relationships and your well-being outside of work. And it allows you to achieve both at the same time. And Brian, I want to thank you. It was a ton of fun and I really enjoyed it.
Bill Furlong, The Character Compass, Transforming Leadership for the 21st Century. Thank you.